week continues on Vermont Edition. Today, the three leading Democrats seeking their party's gubernatorial nomination will meet in a live debate. I'm Bob Kinzel. In recent weeks, we've seen some differences emerge among Sue Minter, Matt Dunn, and Peter Galbraith on a number of issues, including renewable energy, the future of Act 46, and tax policy. The three candidates are with us today in our Montpelier studio to discuss the key issues in their race. Really glad you could all come by today. This is a very important debate. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
And if you're following along on social media, use the hashtag VPR Debate Week to comment on the responses from the candidates in today's debate. Here's our format today, one we've been using all week. In the first half of the program, I'll ask some questions. We'll also have some questions from listeners who've submitted their questions to us over the past week or so. In the second half, the candidates will have an opportunity to ask each other questions. And if time allows, we'll have a lightning round of questions at the end of the program. Please limit your answers to 1 minute. That's really important. And there may be some follow-up questions as well. So let's get started and talk about renewable energy. It certainly generated a lot of controversy in this race in the last week or so. Sue Minter, you say you support the law that was passed by the special legislative session that gives town a greater say in the public service board process. These towns would have what is known as substantial deference in that PSB review, but critics of the law argue this really is not enough, that even with this provision, the public service board can give its approval to a project even if the community is strongly against it. So why are these critics wrong?
You know, I am a strong supporter of renewable energy. I am committed to our state goal, and it's an ambitious one, of 90% renewable by the year 2050. And I know it's going to take a mix of sources of renewable energy to meet that goal, including well-sited wind. I have to say I'm surprised by the 11th hour flip of Matt Dunn, who now claims to support wind but enabling a veto power. I think that will take us backwards, right when we need to go forward. I certainly hear concerns of communities. I want to engage them in the public process and engage their voice in planning. That's what we need to move to move forward. The reason this is so important, Bob, is because climate change is not only here, it is real. I know it from Tropical Storm Irene. I know it from serving on President Obama's task force. And, you know, it's why both Bill McKibben and the Vermont Conservation voters have decided to lend their support for me as the candidate they can trust to push forward on renewable energy.
But the bottom line is, under your position, and correct me if I'm wrong, would be that if a town strongly opposes it, but the public service board determines that it's in the public good, then the project would go forward?
That's correct.
Matt Dunn, let's talk about wind energy. Recently, you said towns should basically have a veto power over the siting of a large wind project. Some people think this position totally undermines the concept of projects that are critical to the public good. And they say if you follow your concept, it might have been very difficult to build Interstates 89 and 91 in Vermont, for instance. So how do you respond to the concern that few, if any, projects would ever be built under this policy?
You know, there's been a big ruckus over the last few days, and let me be clear, it's not about wind siting. I've been called a liar and a flip-flopper, and it's a clear political attack. You know, my position has been consistent, driven by my strong belief that communities have to be involved in decisions about their futures. That's a belief that grounds every piece of my policy platform. I'm not talking about taking it out of the 248 process, but I also know from my time working on large projects in communities around the country that projects never get off the ground if you don't get community input, and you have to have their trust that as you're working with them, you will live by their decision. And if you're an environmentalist, if you're one that really cares about your renewables, I'm the guy who's actually going to move the ball forward because I've demonstrated to communities that I will work with them to get where we need to go.
By taking this stand, aren't you guaranteeing that many of these towns will be embroiled in a nasty debate that essentially pits neighbors against neighbors?
You know, I think that moving forward to 90% renewable energy is not going to be easy. We have to get there, and as I've always said, wind needs to be in the mix. And in order to do that, we need to engage communities in that discussion. I don't think we need to do any new legislation, different from what we did before. I don't think we need to take it out of the 248 process. But what I'm going to do is work with communities directly, supply them with real information and real data, and hope that we can get to a place where we can build the infrastructure that's necessary to move to a clean energy future.
Peter Galbraith, you want to ban industrial wind projects in the future. They're off the table. Hey, they're not going to happen. Some people think your policy shows a lack of support to deal with issues surrounding climate change in Vermont, and they wonder how you could possibly meet the state's goal of having 90% of all energy come from renewable energy sources by the year 2050. How can you?
Well, look, there's a very clear difference among the candidates on this issue. I will protect Vermont's ridgelines by banning all new industrial-scale wind developments. Sue Minter is willing to destroy some ridgelines in order to facilitate industrial-scale projects, and Matt Dunn's position seems to shift with the wind. In my view, ridgelined wind projects are an ecological disaster. To get to the ridgelines, developers need to build interstate-sized highways, they need to blast away mountaintops, they need to pour tons of concrete. And these industrial-scale constructions are destroying our state's most pristine places, the very places that Vermont's species need to migrate to in order to adapt to climate change. These projects do next to nothing about global warming. In fact, the big project in Lowell is equal to 11 hours of New York City traffic, and the energy is not green. We sell the renewable energy credits out of state so that Connecticut utilities and Connecticut industries can continue to burn fossil fuels and call it green. Vermont should not be the dumping ground for Connecticut utilities, and it won't be if I'm governor.
Peter, right now, Vermont's transportation sector is responsible for the greatest amount of the state's carbon emissions. I wasn't able to find anything at your website that deals with this aspect of climate change. So what's your strategy to deal with that?
Well, the first point I make is that electricity, which is where we're putting all of our investment, is basically very little carbon is involved in that. And there's plenty of green energy available, either the Connecticut River dams, solar, which I support properly sited, or buying from Quebec. But in a rural state, there are real limits to what we can do in terms of transportation. Yes, in our more urban areas, we can have more public transportation. So I'd like to build out the broadband and cell network so we can have a Uber-style app, but you know, with a trusted driver program and a trusted passenger program. Somebody going from a rural area isn't going to be interested in a bus that leaves, say, my town of Townsend at 9 a.m. And then returns at 4 p.m. for a shopping trip. But if you had an app, you might connect with a neighbor who's going down, go down, and then come back in your time frame. So I think that's the way we have to deal with it.
Here's an energy question that we got from Jonathan in Shrewsbury.
One of the principal conflicts in Vermont now is between people who do and don't want wind power, who do and don't want solar arrays, who do and don't want natural gas pipelines, not to mention people's concerns about getting our energy from coal, oil, or nuclear power. What will you do as governor to reconcile these differences about the right type, amount, and location of the energy supplies that Vermonters use? Thank you.
Sue Minter?
Thanks for that question. I think the key, I am a professional planner, and I think it is about really planning forward into where and how we meet our renewable energy goals. I want the state to map where energy resources can come from, work with regional planning commissions and local planning commissions to actually do their part in helping to site not only where they do not want facilities, but where they would be willing to site facilities. That's the kind of work we do in Vermont, to come to agreement. And this is the incredibly important work that we must do. And it isn't just about electric sources of energy. It is about transportation. It's why over the last 6 years as the Deputy and Secretary of Transportation, we've expanded public transit. We've expanded rail investments. We are determined to get, under my administration, Amtrak to Burlington and Amtrak back to Montreal. It's why I've been negotiating on a rural Uber system. I call it Ruber, to get more rural rural opportunities, and finally, an EV highway to get electrification of the fleet. Those are the many ways we need to address this.
Peter Galbraith?
Well, so along with nuclear weapons, global warming is one of the two great challenges to human civilization. But the word is, there's two parts of it. There's warming. There's also global. And I, as a diplomat, was involved in the very first treaty to address global warming 29 years ago, the 1987 Montreal Protocol. And so I know that if Vermont has got to play its part, acting alone is going to do no good. We have to do it in conjunction with the rest of the country, and we have to do it in conjunction internationally. So that will be my priority if I'm governor. Now, I want to focus on the things in Vermont that will most reduce our carbon footprint, and that is efficiency and conservation. We get 10 times the carbon reduction for every dollar we invest in efficiency and conservation as compared to what we do by new generating sources. And more importantly, energy and conservation don't have any adverse environmental consequences. We don't have to destroy our pristine habitats if we follow that route.
Matt Dunn.
Bob, when I was the vice chair of the Transportation Committee in the 90s, I was put on that committee to make sure that we worked on issues beyond just bridges and roads. And what I led was an effort to invest in transportation that would reduce our carbon footprint, whether that is commuter buses or when I led the effort to make sure that we kept the Amtrak train in the state of Vermont and helped to negotiate the Amtrak train coming into Rutland. Under my leadership, we will expand rail, we will go to Montreal, we will actually have that a real option for Vermonters. But the other piece is on electronic vehicles. We have been working really, really hard as a state to make sure that there are plug-in stations around. I don't know a Vermonter who doesn't like the idea of what electric car will bring, which is the equivalent of less than $1 per gallon gas. We need to continue to build out that infrastructure, and we need to make sure that we are helping Vermonters who are middle or lower income Vermonters who are having to travel further and further and further for a job, that they can afford an electric vehicle, take advantage of that low cost, and reduce our carbon footprint.
Let's shift gears and talk about the future of Act 46, the state's new school district consolidation law. We've gotten a ton of emails on this subject. Many people are very critical of the idea that school consolidation will essentially be mandatory by 2019. Here are some of the comments we received. Act 46 is having many unintended consequences in Vermont, including dramatically affecting our citizens' relationship to local government. Another one we got, if all goes according to plan, Act 46 will eliminate half of all local school boards in Vermont. Some communities have embraced consolidation, but others see a danger in having the operation of their school taken over by a large regional board. Peter Galbraith, what are your thoughts about Act 46? Do you think it needs to be changed? Should it be voluntary instead of mandatory?
I agree with the comments that were made by the people who emailed you. And yes, Act 46 needs to be changed, and consolidation absolutely should be voluntary. You know, in Vermont, we have this extraordinary system of government which relies on essentially on volunteers. There are thousands of people who are involved in our government, in our school boards, and in the 251 towns with 3 to 5 select people and listers and all of that. And this is an idea to get rid of that volunteer connection, to bring in professionals. In the long term, it's going to have a higher cost. So I think it's the wrong way to go. If, you know, consolidation makes sense where communities want to do it. I think that's in your community, Sue. But in some of my area, which is more rural, people do not want it, and they should not be forced to do it. And I can tell you, if I'm governor, there will be no mandate. Incidentally, we do not have an education spending problem. We have a property tax problem. My commitment as governor is that there will be no increase in the—I will not propose an increase in the state education tax, and I will fund education by shifting some of the cost to the income tax.
Sue Minter, what are your thoughts about how Act 46 is working so far and this whole question of voluntary mandatory?
Yes. Well, I am a working mom with two kids who I've helped through our public school. One is through and one is still in. My husband serves on our school board as a young mom. I volunteered weekly in our schools. I believe strongly that education is critical to our future. Our kids are our future. And I do not want to undermine the very strong public school system that we have. Act 46 is an attempt to focus on how we have very important conversations around significant decline in student enrollment. For more populated regions, like my region, it has been a valuable and difficult conversation. But for us, where we have seven different school boards, seven different budgets for 1,800 students, the decision to unify under one governance system, I believe, will both be cost-effective and valuable to students. But as I have traveled this state running for governor, I hear from small rural communities that one size does not fit all. As governor, I will be flexible. As we implement, I will be appointing four new members of the State Board of Education and will look to flexibility so that we can make sure we move forward but not undermine.
So you feel it should be voluntary, not mandatory. Is that correct?
I want to continue with the discussion. I think we may need to grow the timeline. I think there is much too much pressure on time. I think a decision around restructuring is important. The issue is really, what does the district look like that the school board of education is going to agree to? So I think that flexibility in that criteria is critically important.
Matt Dunn, what are your thoughts about Act 46?
Well, as the only governor candidate in the Democratic Party that actually went to public schools in Vermont, and I now have three kids in Heartland Elementary School where I went, this is deeply personal to me. And I was a big critic of Act 46 as it was even moving its way through the legislature, as my delegation will tell anyone. And that is because I do not believe that one size fits all in Vermont. I don't believe the cookie-cutter legislation works because it puts in danger our secret sauce, which is our community involvement. And I think in Act 46, the extra money for communities that have always wanted to do some kind of consolidation of governance is fine because it's actually really hard work. But I do not believe a 900-student arbitrary target works for most of Vermont. I have been clear, though, that we do need to make greater efficiencies, but I would start with overhead. I don't think we need 60 superintendents for 80,000 kids. I don't believe every school district needs to do its own payroll or its own electronic student record system. And if we roll those up both up statewide, then we can look at our entire state as an education system and do assisted distance learning. That's the future of Vermont, and that's how we can have a superb model rural education in Vermont.
Let's go back to some of our listener questions. This came in from Kara on the issue of childcare.
What can the state do to support child care providers who, on average, make less than $25,000 a year, often without benefits? And we know that our greatest investment, dollar for dollar, is in our children. So I want to know what can be done to help support early educators in the state of Vermont.
Peter Galbraith, what would you say to Kara?
I would say two things that are absolutely central to my campaign, in fact, because the others weren't talking about it, reasons that I got into the campaign. The first is I'm for the $15 minimum wage by 2021, $12.50 immediately. That is going to be a pay raise for all low-wage workers, including those who are carrying out the vital work of taking care of our children. And secondly, she talked about the absence of benefits, and that's why I am for universal publicly financed primary care and preventive health care so that Vermonters can go and see a primary care doctor without having insurance, without having to pay a premium, without a copay or a deductible. It's something that will lead to better outcomes and will save our system money. So I think these are things that will really make a big difference. And not only that, do I put these programs for it, but I'll tell people how to pay for it, which my competitors haven't. I will pay for universal primary care with a payroll tax of 2% on employers, which is a deductible business expense to them and therefore is subsidized in part by the federal government.
Matt Dunn?
So this is a critical issue, and it's one that I know well. I have three children who are 11, 7, and 6, and we just got out of the real challenge of finding affordable child care. And it is a challenge, and it's an increasing challenge as the number of child care providers are fewer and fewer, but the demand is just as high. And the really troubling part is that the way that we now have our child care subsidies structured is that for many Vermonters, when they actually get a raise or a promotion, they are suddenly falling behind because they lose that child care support. And it's an economic development issue. I mean, we have a workforce that needs to be made up of all Vermonters. And when you don't have affordable child care, you lose half. Not sure exactly necessarily which half, but you do, and that's not okay. What I am proposing is first and foremost to get rid of the cliffs, to say that you should not lose your entire child care support when you get a small raise. So we can actually make sure that that goes away and increase investment in early child care. It's the best investment out there. You know, right now we spend the most when it does the least amount of good in higher education and the least at the earliest years. We need to reverse that and lower special ed costs. We can do that in Vermont.
Sue Minter.
Well, thank you so much for the important question. It is so important for our future. As a mom, I have struggled very critically at key times when I was in work and couldn't find child care that was either accessible or affordable. I know the struggle is really increasing, and things are getting worse, particularly for women. You know, women who work full-time in Vermont, 43% of women who work full-time still cannot meet their basic needs. And we know that actually over 40% of our kids are coming to kindergarten unready to learn. This is because of this challenge of poverty and the many challenges that families are facing, and we must address early childhood education and child care because we know that the brain is at its most important time of development in the first 3 years of life. So we need a system. We don't have a system of child care. And in this day and age, when so many single-headed households and female-headed households are struggling, this is a priority we need to address, and we will.
Let's get one more listener question in. We got this from Larry in Brandon.
Question I have is for all of the Democratic candidates, but especially Sue Minter. The question is, what was Peter Shumlin's biggest failing as governor? Thank you.
Sue Minter, you served as a member of the governor's cabinet. What's your answer?
You know, I will say that something that the governor never took on as an issue, and I will, is the issue around gun safety. You know, we are dealing with an epidemic of gun violence in this country, and Vermont is not immune. And that's why I am proud to have been the first candidate to actually call for gun safety and specifically background checks for all gun sales. You know, this has not been an election year conversion for me, Matt. I think this is your third statewide run for office. I am glad you have joined this call now because we have a problem in Vermont, and it is actually behind closed doors. And I'm talking about domestic violence. Most of the homicides in Vermont are domestic violence related, and most of those are with a firearm. In states where there are background checks on all gun sales, 46% fewer women are shot to death by their domestic partners. That's why I will stand strong as governor to lead on this important issue. We know this is not just the right issue, but also the right time. Thank you.
Peter Galbraith?
I think it's hard to think of just one item, but I'll cite two. The first was Act 48, the failure to follow through on single-payer health care. Governor Shumlin pushed through a plan to provide health care, and then he didn't come forward with a plan to pay for it, even though there was actually only one way to pay for it. I am the only elected official in the state of Vermont who believes sufficiently in single-payer health care that I actually put forward legislation to finance it. And the reason I believe in it is that I've been a diplomat. I've seen that every other country has this kind of healthcare system. It covers everybody. It provides equally good or sometimes better outcomes, and it costs half the amount. The other failure of the Shumlin administration I would cite is the failure to exercise oversight over the EB-5 projects. And this is the nexus between corporate money and government, because the he failed to oversee people who were major contributors to his campaign. I am the only candidate who has never accepted corporate money. And now we find today that both of my competitors, one has a super PAC that's helping her, and another has a corporate buddy who's pumping $250,000 into the race in the last 3 days.
And I'm sure that's a topic we'll get to in the second half of the program. Matt Dunn, what is Governor Peter Shumlin's biggest failing?
You know, Vermonters are really hungry for trust, and it comes from a really tough 4 years. Whether it was pulling the plug on moving forward with universal health care, whether it was the complete and total debacle of the Health Connect website, which $250 million later is still not working, or the EB-5 scandal that has rocked trust in this state, where individuals who were supposedly being overseen and vetted by the state pulled off the biggest Ponzi scheme that the FEC has ever seen. And that is devastating to Vermonters. That's why I called for transparency back in April. That's why I've been talking about transparency now and relationships and how we have contracts with the individuals who perpetrated that scheme. And I believe we need a fresh start, a clean break, to be able to rebuild that trust and get Vermont back on track.
Well, that concludes the first part of our program today. When we come back, the candidates will ask each other questions. You're listening to the Democratic Governor's Debate on Vermont Public Radio. This is Debate Week on Vermont Edition, and today we have the leading candidates who are seeking the Democratic nomination for governor. With us are Matt Dunn, Peter Galbraith, and Sue Minter. In the second part of the program, the candidates have an opportunity to ask each other questions. The questions should be no longer than 30 seconds. We're looking for questions, not speeches. The responses should be no longer than a minute, and a brief follow-up question is certainly allowed. So let's start with the questions. I put all of your names in a hat and drew them out to determine this order. Sue Minter, you go first. Who do you have a question for?
I have a question for Peter. Peter, Bernie Sanders proposed tuition-free public education paid with a transaction tax on Wall Street. I am taking that idea home to Vermont by proposing Vermont Promise, 2 years tuition-free community and technical college, and paying for it with a fee on big banks. Peter, you want to pay for your plan in a regressive way by eliminating the earned income tax credit, one of the most successful anti-poverty programs that we have. Now, you and I are the only ones that have laid out a real plan. How will you accomplish your plan in the first term, as I will?
Well, thank you, Sue, and I certainly congratulate you on your plan, and I would support the bank tax so we can add $5 million to my proposal. I just think your plan is utterly inadequate. You are only providing 2 years free tuition and only at Vermont Technical College or the Community College of Vermont. My plan is for 4 years free tuition at all five of the Vermont State Colleges, and I pay for it. I don't repeal the earned income tax credit, not at all. I keep it. So that's just a lie. But I pay for it by repealing $28.5 million in special interest tax breaks, like the tax break that the exemption from the sales tax that owners of private jets had, or the sales tax exemption just enacted for people on the cloud, or the ones for rich people who have municipal bonds. And so, Sue, the reason I want to raise the minimum wage, when you raise the minimum wage, of course, people earn more, so they might not get as much of the earned income tax credit, but that's how the law works now, Sue. So my question to you is, how about getting rid of some of those special interest tax breaks? You can use your follow-up.
So I want to follow up, please, because as I've reviewed your proposal, $18 million comes from elimination of the EITC, which you say they won't need because there will be a $15
million. There's no elimination of it. It's simply that as incomes go up, there are people no longer qualified because they're making more money. But that's the law.
Excuse me, but you have told us that your goal is to get to $15 minimum wage by 2021. So that's 8 years from now. Peter, I have a plan.
2021 is not 8 years.
Whatever it is. It's not now, and it isn't achievable in this term. My plan will achieve 2 years tuition-free in the first year. I have a plan
to pay
for it.
So you're not even for the $15 minimum wage.
So well, we'll want a project that is actually achievable with the legislators to back it.
Peter Galbraith, who gets your first question?
Well, Matt Dunn does.
Excellent.
And Matt, you spoke of trust, and both of you and Sue made a great show of returning your corporate campaign contributions. I point out I've never accepted any. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, you even ran ads about how you were the first candidate to do it. Mm-hmm. Now we learn Sue has a super PAC, and today Reid Hoffman, one of your early campaign contributors and a friend, has just announced he's spending $220,000 in the last 3 days of this election. Mm-hmm. So my question for you is, will you denounce Reid Hoffman for putting all this corporate money into the campaign? And incidentally, did you coordinate with him? I think it's almost impossible to believe that he came along in the last 3 days without you being in touch, just at the time your campaign was running into desperate trouble.
Mm-hmm. You know, Peter, it came as a surprise to us, like everyone else. Didn't know it was coming. But I'm not surprised that it actually came after the biggest lobbying firm in Montpelier created a super PAC to put money behind an ad that is dishonest about my commitment to clean energy. Reid Hoffman spent his teenage years in Vermont. He's a friend. And he's getting involved in the most transparent way possible, making a statement and putting his name on it.
Would you like to have a follow-up question?
Well, I guess I would say if you believe that somebody plopped $220,000 in the last three days of the election and it was a total surprise, I've got some great investment opportunities in a biotech company in Newport you might be interested in. The truth is, people pretend there's no coordination. In fact, there is coordination. This is entirely what's wrong with the system. And I absolutely think there was coordination there. This is really skirting the law. And I'm also concerned, Sue, about your super PAC.
Sue, would you like to respond?
Yes. I want you to understand that I want to overthrow Citizens United. I am against super PACs. I think the role of big money in politics is undermining our democracy in very serious ways. But as you know, Peter, I had no idea about the development of resources to do an ad. There's nothing I can do to coordinate with this. That would be a violation of the law. I found out about this last night when my campaign manager called me after a call from Paul Heinz announcing that there was now an announcement about something going into play for me. Nothing I can do about it.
Yes, you can ask them not to do it. Will you ask them not to do it right now?
We cannot coordinate.
You can ask them right on the air. You can say, please do not do this.
We can neither ask. We're not allowed to
coordinate. That's not coordination. You have a free speech right. You are perfectly entitled to ask them not to do it. I'm going to say here, if anybody is thinking about spending money independently in support of my campaign, do not do so. I will denounce you to the heavens if you try to do that in my campaign because it's wrong. It's not the Vermont way. $250,000 into a campaign, it just blows the mind. You know, for a campaign that wasn't – well, now it's crossed well over the $1 million mark. Incredible.
Including the money that you put into your own campaign, Peter?
Yeah, I put in $200,000.
Okay.
And I can tell you, it isn't special interest money. It isn't some big Google, tech executive who might be wanting to do the Vermont Health Connect exchange. You know, when you put that kind of money in, somebody wants something.
All right, Matt Dunn, who gets your first question?
So Peter does. And so, Peter, we have a universal background check gun safety rally this afternoon. And Sue has claimed that she is the strongest on gun safety. But I've been at a number of forums with you, and I'm not sure that that is correct. So I'm working hard to make sure everyone knows what everyone's positions are, and I would love to hear what your full position is on gun safety.
Well, thank you, Matt. First, I'll give Sue credit. She started this at the beginning of the race for universal background checks. You were not there. Mm-hmm. You came along. But as Sue knows, that from the moment I entered the race, I also was for universal background checks. I'll tell you where I took the lead, though, which is in the call to ban military-style assault rifles, and by which I mean weapons that have large-capacity magazines that are automatic or semi-automatic that are designed to do what you want on a battlefield, which is to kill large numbers of people in short periods of time. And having served in a number of war zones, I have actually seen the consequences of these weapons. They have no use for hunting, no use for self-defense. Therefore, I do not think they should be sold in the state of Vermont. I will make that a priority of my administration. Sue has said she'll sign it if it comes to her, but it isn't a priority of her gun control plan. I have a couple of other provisions. I think if you're on the terrorism list or the no-fly list, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun. And I'm in favor of banning the sale of cop-killing bullets, armor-piercing bullets.
Sue Minter, it's actually time for you to ask another candidate a question, and maybe you can fold that in your answer and follow up into that.
Okay, I will just follow up by saying what's so important here is that all three of us are now on the same page, that we are going to a rally because we will not see change in this issue at the national level, not when we have a virtual sit-in in the House of Representatives, and they will not even raise the issue. I am prepared to lead, and when Vermont leads, the nation can follow. My question is actually to Peter. Peter, throughout this campaign, you and I have been able to disagree without being disagreeable. As a former diplomat, I'm interested in hearing how important it is to you that we maintain integrity in our political discourse.
Sue, I think it's terribly important, and I want to commend you for having been able to disagree agreeably. I think that's a special trait of Vermont, but I think we're in danger of losing another special trait of Vermont, which is, you know, that we're not going to let big money decide things. And when a guy from California puts $220,000 in the last 3 days of the race, I think that's a huge problem to our discourse. And, you know, yes, I also think it's not a good idea for a super PAC to come in. But look, I'm not going to be extreme here. That's $20,000. It's an entirely different order of magnitude. So, yes, you know, we've managed to come a long way without in keeping civil discourse. And I think you've done your part to do that. Thanks, Sue.
Peter Galbraith, who gets your second question?
Matt Dunn. So, Matt, on Friday you issued a press release saying, quote, "If a town votes down the wind project by Australian ballot, I will use all the power of the governor's office to ensure that is the end of the project." Isn't signing a bill one of the powers of the Vermont governor? And so, if a bill comes across your desk giving a town a veto, and that is the only way to stop the project, will you sign that bill?
Peter, you know, this discussion that we've been having together on what the definition of all is, I guess makes me understand some of the challenges you had when you were in the Senate, when I wasn't there, because I'm sorry that you had a misunderstanding. What I have said all along is that I would negotiate in good faith with our communities, because I think it is very important for individuals in the community where a wind project is going to be sited to have a seat at the table. I have also all along said that I do not support new legislation. I think that the bill that passed at the end was a good step forward and I think is fine. But what I meant in that statement and what I have further clarified is that I will use the power of the Public Service Department and other power that the governor has to make sure that when a community, after I've tried really hard to get them on board, if they say no, I will oppose that project in the proceedings at the Public Service Board.
Would you like a follow-up question?
Well, I think you've been doing a lot of clarifying in the last week on this issue. I do note these are not my words, but your words. Mm-hmm. I will use all the power of the governor's office to ensure that that is the end of the project. And I would note that signing a bill is one of the powers of the governor. So tell me, what is it that, you know, I don't understand about the word all? Because to me, doesn't all mean every? all? I mean, what's the Matt Dunn definition
Peter,
of all?
I'm glad this got out here. I didn't know that this was going to be the biggest issue of the campaign. You know, the fact that I've been called a flip-flopper or a liar is really just a political attack because I have been consistent. It's on the record that I've been consistent. And this is where I am. I believe that no project should go forward without an affirmative vote from the community where the project will be cited. I do not feel there's a need for new legislation, and I don't think we need to change the 248 process. I just wish that people would not be taking my position, which has been consistent all the way along, out of context, and having this kind of attack.
Matt Dunn, which candidate gets your second question?
So my second question is actually for Sue. And Sue, as has been mentioned a couple of times, your super PAC, which is being run by the largest lobbying firm in the state of Vermont, is releasing an ad today that calls you the only candidate to support clean energy. And so I know you don't have any control over the ads that they put out. I just want to know if you think that that statement is true. Out of the three of us, are you the only candidate that's in favor of clean energy?
Well, first I want to say that I think that this recent, what I consider a flip on wind, or at least a clarification that in fact we may see wind projects that in fact are not able to proceed, is leaving me as the clean energy candidate. I think that's exactly why Bill McKibben changed his position to endorsing, instead of endorsing you, to endorse me. It's exactly why many, many environmental activists reached out to me after your clarification statement to say that they would like to support me. It's why I've been hearing that again and again. And by the way, I've also been hearing, unfortunately, a concern of some who had already voted, who wished that they had heard this before their vote. So I am certainly standing strong. I know this isn't always being a leader. It doesn't mean always taking the most popular position. It means sticking to your principles. It means being someone with integrity and trust and consistency at all, whenever possible.
Okay. Sue, I'm not sure you answered the question, though. So do you think that the statement is accurate that you are the only, because that's what they're saying, that you are the only candidate that supports clean energy?
I have not seen the ad that you're talking about. I know that I am the candidate who is standing strong on clean energy today. I know that is why Bill McKibben is supporting me. It's why the conservation voters are supporting me. It's why I have worked tirelessly for the last 6 years on looking towards how do we address climate change, working on Obama's task force on climate preparedness and resilience, being asked by Bernie Sanders to testify in Congress about infrastructure and climate change. These are issues that are deeply important to me, and I believe I am the leader who has the experience, who has the vision, and yes, the skills to lead on this issue, to continue leading on this issue.
We're going to go to our lightning round, get at least one or two questions in before the program is over. Please keep your answers a little shorter this time. If you could do it in 10 or 15 seconds, that would be very helpful. Let's start off with a tax pledge that was made, I think, in the Republican gubernatorial debate. Those two candidates have vowed not to raise any taxes during their first term in office. They say they will veto any effort by lawmakers to increase any taxes. I want to know, can you make that same pledge right now, Matt Dunn?
You know, I got to say that those kinds of claims are simply irresponsible. And that's particularly true in the really difficult issues that we are facing. And I want to highlight one in particular. We have a heroin epidemic that is ravaging our state. The governor has done a good job of talking about it. We have not funded it. We need to make sure that we are doing everything we can to invest in prevention, to make sure no one has to wait 300 days for treatment, and to make sure that we have community organizers on the ground to end this heroin epidemic.
Peter Galbraith?
Now,
My pledge is to eliminate special interest tax breaks that the legislature has snuck into the tax code. And my pledge is to adequately fund essential public services. And my pledge is to raise the revenues necessary to do so. And that will include raising taxes on those who are most able to pay.
Sue Minter.
I'm not going to take such of a pledge. I see that we have huge problems in our state and obviously across this country. Too many Vermonters are struggling just to make ends meet. You know, I am here because I know that there are too many children in poverty, too many homeless people, and we need to do our part to meet the challenges.
It's time now for our final question, and we're going to reverse the order that we used at the beginning of the program. You've got a minute for your answer. Here's the question. If you could pick one major goal that you could achieve in your first term in office, what would it be and why? Peter Galbraith?
Well, my goals are economic justice and fighting inequality. And I will be the governor who will enact a $15 minimum wage because that is the best anti-poverty program we could have in Vermont. It will save the taxpayers money because as people make more money, they'll get less in public assistance. And it will boost the local economy because low-wage workers spend their money. And it will reduce inequality from, say, the difference between the CEO of McDonald's, who makes $8 million, and the lowest-paid worker, $15,000, 800-to-1 ratio, to a mere 400-to-1 ratio. I will fight inequality by providing every Vermont high school graduate with 4 years free tuition at the state colleges, and I'll pay for it by eliminating special interest tax breaks that benefit a handful of wealthy people. I'm the candidate who's had the courage to offer a financing plan for single-payer health care, and I'm going to continue that fight. So these are the priorities that I have for economic justice.
Matt Dunn.
Now, what I've been saying all along is that the agenda that Bernie Sanders has brought to the rest of the nation, we have the opportunity to bring back here to Vermont. And that's to make sure that we have an economy that works for all Vermonters and for all Vermont. That includes making sure that no one works 40 hours a week and is still in poverty. That includes making a once-in-a-generation investment in affordable housing. That means actually ensuring equal pay for equal work. And it means that we are not going to let a broken website get in the way of moving forward to universal health care reform. Vermont is struggling in many ways. We have the most extraordinary state in the world. With fresh leadership and a fresh approach, we can move our state in a new direction.
Sue Minter.
In my first term, Bob, I am going to promote and implement Vermont Promise. That's 2 years tuition-free community college or at Vermont Technical College. Why? Because right now, 4 out of 10 kids are not continuing their education after high school, and 2/3 of the jobs require it. If we don't address this opportunity gap, we will lose. It is going to be a win-win-win, a win for the students, a win for the employers who are looking for that trained workforce, and a win for all of the future of our economy. And you know what? The banks are going to pay their fair share so that students can get a fair shake. I'm also going to create economic opportunity through my program Invest Vermont, investing in local communities to create vibrant communities with affordable housing and jobs for the future. And finally, I am going to address our clean water problem, both cleaning up Lake Champlain and the drinking water that not only plagues southern Vermont and Bennington, but throughout this state. Thank you.
Well, that's going to do it for our Democratic Governor's Debate on Vermont Edition. Many thanks to the candidates for being part of our program, Sue Minter, Matt Dunn, and Peter Galbraith. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Debate Week on Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sengary, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Our director today was Mary Williams. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Thanks for listening.